Celebrating 40 years of BADC. I've never heard of it. And now, 10 minutes with a f***ing legend. I can't wait.
Okay, here I am with Ronnie Johansson on the Gold Coast. How are you, Ronnie?
I'm good, thanks, Gary. Very good, thank you. Lovely to see you. And yeah. Good you had time to come down and talk to me.
No problems. I'd make time for you anytime, mate.
Oh,
you
get out. Give me a break.
We start most of these with, you know, where did you get started in the business? But I'm going to start with, what are you up to now?
Well, like we were talking before, you keep very busy, as I do. I am the national president of the Australian Cinematographers Society, which pretty well occupies most of my life. And means I travel all over Australia and get to Europe and the
Fantastic.
States every now and then to attend conferences and things like that. But I still direct and shoot. Mm-hmm. I just finished a job for my old mate Johnny Anderson mm-hmm. at Red Suit. And I'm doing some other things with QUT. I lecture at Bond and mentor at Griffith. So it's a pretty full existence,
yeah.
But I do, Gary, enjoy sitting on my ass doing nothing. I do enjoy it.
Well, it's a pretty good outlook right here, yeah.
But I can do that anywhere.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't need a golf course to do that. I can do that really well anywhere. But I miss the, I do miss the camaraderie and what we had. And I know that sounds a little bit, maybe it's a bit of romantic, but I think we had the best of it. When I say we, I mean even your good self and Coops,
yep.
Steve Cooper, and Greville Patterson, who we were talking about before, and Noel Harris, the sledge, God mm-hmm. loving Jesus, I miss the sledge, I tell you. I really do. Even though he could be the most exasperating person, I really do miss
yep.
the old sledge. And Maxie Banner, Bobby Blaisdell, Dickie Marks, all these people. But the work was one thing, but it was the bloody people we met. I mean, that we had terrific relationships with people, you know? And I don't think egos got in the way too much back then. I don't know, maybe we all seemed to get on so well.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going over to your place there, the old Sweet 16 with God loving Murray Lyons, and sitting in on sessions on a regular basis and thinking, God, how bloody good is this that...
Yeah.
We can collaborate on things and you can sit with the likes of yourself and people and just be part of it.
Mm.
You don't have to open your big mouth, but it was just part of the whole thing. You'd start the job and you'd finish the job. Go
process.
Right through.
Yeah,
it was a real pleasure,
I suppose for people listening to this, we should actually talk about who you are and what you've done and, you know, where you started. So we'll come back to a lot of what we were just talking about. But,
all right.
You're a cinematographer, is that what you would call yourself, or what are you...
Yeah, I've always been a cinematographer.
Yeah.
I started in 1965 in Melbourne. I was 15 and got a job at Crawford Productions as a message boy, you know, doing the groceries for Hector Crawford. And I had a big job there as meeting him every morning at the front of Collins Street and carrying his bag upstairs to his desk. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, it's a big job. And mind you, it was a big job because all of us junior kids, and there were a mob of us, that's the job we wanted. You know, we'd fill kerosene heaters and run errands and run off homicide scripts and, you know, on the old Gestetner, the hand-wound Gestetners.
What's a Gestetner?
A Roneo machine,
right.
A printer.
Right.
And we'd do all that sort of shit. Yeah.
Awesome.
So it was a good learning ground.
Yeah.
And then I eventually got sacked from Crawford's because I became an adult, and some people would say they probably think I've never become an adult, but I think I hit where you got adult pay, and so they sacked me because
too expensive.
Yeah, well, I was getting £6 a week, I think, or $12 a week, and I think it went up to 18, so they gave me the flick. So I went freelance.
So what, you were there for 3 years?
2 years.
2 years. And,
that's when I started to learn what I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
Because I'd made 8mm films as a school kid.
Yeah.
And then when I went to Crawford's, I realised, this is what I want to do. This is where I belong.
Mm.
Because I was not a very good student at school. But I always did pretty well in written subjects, you know, like history and... composition, as we had back then, and English expression. But I was ratchet at things like trades and turning and fitting, woodwork, maths hopeless, technical drawing, shallow geometry, all those things. And I was never destined to become, I think, what every boy was expected then, that's to get a trade, and I just couldn't do it. I was hopeless.
It's interesting. There's a real common theme developing in these podcasts that the people that I've interviewed, at least, where everybody's left school early.
Yeah.
And everybody started with a whatever you can do to get into the industry, you'll do. But also, everybody has been super aware and doing stuff when they were kids. Like you just said, you've been making 8mm films when you were a kid, you know. So you obviously had an awareness of what you wanted to do, or just a love of this whole thing called cinematography right from the word go.
Oh, I was just making a film. And there was a great underground movement in Melbourne at that time of 8mm filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
It started by a fellow called Chris Lafane. And we all sort of looked up to him as being a bit of a god. And yet he was probably only 12 months, 18 months older than we were.
Yeah.
But he made the most fantastic films. And this is, I'm not doing, no disrespect intended. I don't think Chris ever realised his full potential.
Mm.
But maybe he didn't want to. Maybe he did other things. But Jesus, I'll tell you what.
Mm.
As they say, that Camelot line, for one brief shining moment, boy, he was as hot as. He was so good.
Mm.
And a great storyteller.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's a major part of filmmaking, isn't it? Storytelling.
Well, that's all we are, even as cinematographers. We're just storytellers.
Yeah.
We just tell stories through the lens. And we kid ourselves if we're anything more than that.
So you left Crawford's. What happened then?
Oh, I went freelance, and I didn't even know what the word freelance meant. But I went to senior film house with Fred Skepsey and worked there in his early days. And then I went to senior films as an operator. And then I went back to being a camera assistant. And then I finally got a job shooting at a very early age. I was only about 18, I think. And someone said, you shoot this commercial. And it was a commercial for the launch of the Stubby into Australia, the glass Stubby. And I got thrown into this job and I was thrilled to bits. And I turned up on location. I remember the day as if it were yesterday. And it was in a room of mirrors. And the director said, he said, I want to do a 360 move around the Stubby in a mirrored room. So I looked at him and I said, I scratched my head. And they were all waiting for me to deliver the right answer.
Mm.
And luckily I did.
Yeah.
And I just looked around, all these very experienced men, you know. And I said, well, why don't we just put it on a turntable? And they all looked at me and they went,
genius.
Let's do it. They'd already worked that out, you know. They were just testing to see if I could come up with the same idea. But I must admit, Gary, for 1 minute I was trying to work out how I could do a dolly all the way around
and
keep everyone out of shot. So it went from that to other things, and I started to get a bit of a reputation as a pretty, I won't say the word hot because that's not right, but just as a good young DP or cinematographer who was moving past the old traditional hard light of these wonderful old blokes that have gone before me into soft light, into more direct light. There was a bit of a movement that had just started. And you've got to remember, I came through at that time when there were people like Russell Boyd and John Seale and Peter James, all these, Graham Lynn, these great young men who have since gone on to be old men like me, not so much you, but like I am now. So we were coming through as this resurgence.
Mm.
Mind you, I don't put myself in the league of Russell Boyd or Johnny Seale or any of those boys, but we just did things differently. And we suffered for it in many ways because it was not an easy road to change the thinking of this generation that went before us.
Mm.
It's a little bit different now because the generation that we've encouraged to come through has had technology on their side and the technology has changed. We didn't.
Mm.
We simply had to change a movement. And so we did that, and so I discovered this soft light, which was just coming in, which is now, I guess, probably called direct light or source light. And then I did something wrong, I don't know. It was all, we were always reviewed by the older cinematographers, and I did something wrong, and was quite rightly put back to being an assistant.
You mean technique-wise?
Oh, yeah, something. I did something wrong, and I don't know what it was. I'm sure if I thought back, I could probably work it out.
Yeah.
It was something to do with what I did on the job. I did some operating that wasn't up to scratch.
Right.
Because you're marked pretty highly, you know,
yeah.
Which is why when you came from that learning ground, what you've taken through the rest of your life, is that's what you expect from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's the magpies. The magpies come in at this time. Yeah. Anyway, so and so I was sent back to being an assistant and had to spend a little time in purgatory doing what I thought I was past.
How long did that...
6 months, I think, they gave me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So when you say they, are you talking about in a particular company? Or
yes, I was at Senior Films.
Yeah, that's right.
And we had I think there were four or five crews. It was a big place.
And your first major thing was a commercial, your first sort of...
I started in drama.
Oh, okay.
In television drama.
Okay. Well, going back to the commercial you talked about before, that was your first introduction to advertising.
That's correct.
Yeah, so... You know, was that a one-off for a little while and then...
Yes.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Senior Films were a commercial production company in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And, but then I went back to doing drama and...
Okay.
And then back to commercial. You sort of did everything.
Yeah.
Not unlike what happens today. And then I was on a job one day as a cameraman in Melbourne and I got a call from Mike Williams up here in Brisbane.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he'd heard about me and... do I want to come to Queensland? I said, well, for a job. And he said, yeah, full time. I said, full time?
Yeah.
I said, shit, you know, and I was doing all right in Melbourne. You know, I was making, I think I was making $85 a day as a cameraman.
Awesome.
$85 a day.
Mm.
And I thought, gee, where's this? And he said to me, well, we'll give you, I think it was $400 a week.
Mm.
$400 a week? Bloody hell. I said, oh, I'll think about it. And I just got married. We'd had a child, my daughter Kelly. And so we decided to move. And so that's in 76. And I came up to Queensland to start work with Martin Williams Films, with Mike and Gail and Johnny Stainton and Henry Pierce and Coops was there. Bobby had just left and Dick had just left, which is why they were looking for someone. Yeah. And it was just a breath of fresh air. It was, for a start, being in Queensland, which I'd only been to on a commercial down on the Gold Coast, shooting on the beach down there. I think it was for Shell.
Okay.
I think it was Shell, yeah. With a director called Max Varnell. Rob Copping, I think, shot the commercial, I think. And so then it started at Martin Williams Films.
Yeah. And so what was the basis of your work there? Was it more into sort of advertising?
Oh, yeah, it was all commercial. Oh, they did a lot of docos as well.
Right.
Which is why I think... They needed to fill the space that Dick Marks left.
Yeah.
And it was a big... They were big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
Big shoes.
Because
he had created a movement here, as I spoke to you briefly about before, and had lifted the standards of Brisbane advertising and Brisbane commercials to a whole different level, you know. And I had worked at the same level in a southern market, you know, which at that time was perceived to be a superior market to Queensland. I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's just the perception that Brisbane was a retail town and all the corporate work came from down south. Well, Dick started to change that thinking. And I know I'm saying Dick because at the time I do believe his impact on the local industry was pretty spectacular. And I think he had some good people. I think Alan Hartley was working away there at Garnsey's. I don't think Nancy was even in the industry then. I think she was probably still at school. Beautiful Nancy, who we all love. And but Georgie Muskins was here.
Yeah.
Greville was here. Was Greville here? Yeah, he would have been here in 76, maybe a bit later. But anyway, all these people that, and definitely Noel was here and a few other people. So I had some big shoes to fill and I didn't direct. I don't know why they thought I directed, because I didn't. I shot. That's all I was. So, of course, when I come up here, they say to me, oh, well, here's your first script. And it was for Starlight, Awnings and Blinds. And I'd met Katie Dell. Oh, Katie was here, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, gee, what a talent. She was a remarkable talent. I don't think anybody realises just how good Katie was.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people say things, but I don't think they realise just how good she really was. And so she and I became pretty good friends. And I met Tony Dell, the big buffhead. And we became very close mates because of our love of cricket. And she used to write these bloody terrific ads. And she wrote this Starlight stuff. And I read it and I thought, oh, that's nice, but I can't, you know, I didn't even think I could direct it. So I said to them, look, I think you got the wrong bloke. And they said, what do you mean? I said, well, I don't direct. And Mike Williams, God love him, he said, well, you've seen Bloody Learn. He said, I'll get someone else to work on this one and you shoot it. He said, but we'll give you a walk-up start. I said, all right, okay. Yeah. So Jonathan Dawson directed it, who I'd worked with in Melbourne as a director on drama. And a lovely fellow, and a terrific writer. I'm not sure about him as a director, but he certainly delivered, as he did on this. It was terrific. But I watched him very closely, as I'd had the opportunity to do with so many other directors. And so I directed the next one.
So was it simply a matter of just taking that step? Because you probably had the, you know, you probably had the knowledge, you just didn't realise you had it.
Oh, shit, scared. Oh, yeah. I had to... Yeah, that's all it was.
Yeah.
So once I took it...
Yeah.
I loved it. I relished it. It was terrific because...
Did you shoot and direct from then on?
Yeah, and Brisbane became known for director DPs.
Mm.
But, yeah, Brisbane led the way in that particular field.
Interesting.
Yeah. Not because I was there, but there were some other good ones. I think Stan Boothman. They were all relatively unknown, apart from Dick.
Mm.
And forgive me if I've forgotten anyone, but Trevor Hone came along a little bit later, and Trevor was very good at what he did.
So from then on, you're pretty much fully entrenched in the whole Queensland advertising scene, Australia-wide, I suppose. But certainly in the Brisbane thing, you were a major figure. Everybody knew who you were. Everybody, you know, loved working with you and all that sort of stuff. What are some good campaigns that you can remember from those days?
Oh, gee whiz. Well, I did a lot. And when I look back on it, I think, geez, I don't how fancy doing all that work.
Mm.
But as you would remember, we did a lot. We did all the Mirage stuff.
Yeah.
Well, of course, look, it then became the 80s.
Mm.
And I think we all made a lot of money in the 80s and we all did some pretty terrific work because we were given the opportunity to do the work.
That's
and we were
right.
given the opportunity to contribute to the work. You know, you weren't brought on board for your good looks. And I must admit, I've had some tense times on sets with people. But in the end, the job will get done and the right one will come. But I'm not a great believer in doing two versions.
Mm.
I think the people that we work with are smart enough to know which is the right version, whether it's my version or your version or the agency's version. It doesn't matter.
Mm.
There is only one real way to do it, and I think sometimes these days we lose sight of that fact, and we do 20 versions for...
What's brought that about, do you reckon?
A technology, I think, and also the willingness. Before we had the Video Village, I think the willingness for people to want to contribute more.
Mm.
Like, you would say, yes, okay, look, I'm happy to do that because I can see there's a valid reason for it.
Mm.
But then it gets a little bit out of hand sometimes because... It confuses, if there's actors involved, it confuses them because they don't know what you want from them. They don't know what you're expecting. So, you know, it happens still today, but I don't think it's one of the endearing facets of our industry, but that's the way it is, and you say, okay, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I can just remember the fact that Sweet 16, when I first bought into the business, we had one reverb unit. No, that was it. You didn't have any more. So Peter Blyton... If he wanted to use more than one effect, he would have to commit that reverb to tape, and that was it from then on. You couldn't change it.
Yeah, that's
so, you know, there was a certain amount of, okay, I'm going to make a commitment to that, and I can see the end result in my head, you know, while I'm doing it.
But it reflects in a similar way to that with technology that, like, we would filter a lot of the cameras then. We'd filter and actually put the colour and the tone into the lens.
Yeah.
So it went through to the film, and we shot film, of course. We never shot data.
Yeah.
And that was it. Once you committed, you committed. Of course, now we don't commit. We will give what we call a generic look, which is, I think, called raw. And then later on, you grade it. I remember Johnny Anderson, the first time I shot data, digital, the new digital, it was on an Arri Alexa, which is a terrific camera. I got it, back, and I'm up there in the post lounge, and he's looking at the image on the screen, and it looks like it's pale, it's white, it's nothing at all. He looked at me, he said, listen, he said, are you going to colour this shit in? And I laughed. I said, yeah, we're going to colour it in. He said, well, can I see it if it's going to be coloured in? So, of course, I'd done a version that I shot to, which I think is called 709 or some bloody thing. And so Coops just pushed a button and, he said, that's good, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's led us into a few traps, particularly in advertising, but also in long-form work drama, that people sit in an edit suite for a long time looking at these flat, raw images, and when you grade them, they say, what's that?
Mm.
You say, well, that's it's graded. Mm. And they say, but we liked it the way it was.
Yeah, they've gotten used to it or whatever.
You're right. Mm. It's a bit like humming a tune one way, over and over again, and they say, well, we don't want all those trumpets.
We like the demo.
Yeah, exactly. How many times have you heard that?
Yeah, plenty.
Yeah, so that's what has transpired now. And so we have to re-educate people because the role of the cinematographer has changed so much, so much, you know.
Just talk about that for a sec. So in what ways?
Well, we used to be the magicians of the industry, whether people want to admit that. We were. Nobody knew what happened inside that camera. Nobody knew. Yeah. You know, we knew. We knew what went in one end and came out the other. Mm-hmm. We knew how to control it. We knew how to light things. We knew how to do this.
Yep.
There was no video split. There was nothing. Mm. It was under our control. And then when the video split started to arrive, and I think I bought the first one into Queensland, it was because we at that time used to do a lot of commercials for America that had to be copied frame for frame by the big company. It was for Wrigley's and so it had to be frame for frame. So you needed a video split, you know. Mm. And sort of as the technology has progressed even further, we no longer, and there's more people sitting in the video split tent looking at different monitors and having differing opinions on things that sadly we hear on the set, which does tend to drag you down a little bit, you know, because you think, well, hang on, just let me do what I want to do and then, you know. I've got to tell you, I'm pretty well used to it now, better than I was. But even today, I still find it a little grating that people in advertising don't let you do your job properly.
Mm.
I don't believe they do. I could be wrong, but I don't think they do let us do our job. Unless, of course, you're someone like Mark Toyers of the world, the David Dineens of the world in particular, the Ian McKenzie's of the world, Ian McKenzie in particular, and David, because they just stand out. But if you're a bit of a bloody journeyman, like I believe I am, and there's nothing wrong with any of that, you do tend to come back a little bit to the field, so you have to listen to a lot of stuff that you think, oh boy, I can't believe that you want to even discuss that.
So, and people coming from an uneducated in that field.
Oh yeah, but
it's just an opinion, really. Isn't
that's
it?
Correct. Yeah, but they're educated in a different world technology, and everybody can pick up a camera now and shoot a really serviceable image, not necessarily usable, good image, but serviceable without any fear at all. And the technology is fantastic. But there has to be a middle ground somewhere along the line where you still let the person who you've hired to do the job do their job.
Do their job, yeah.
You've got to let them do their job, otherwise you might as well go out and do it yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Yeah.
I do feel sorry for the post houses too, somewhere along the line, because of the talent, the rich talent they've got in-house, that, and with technology changing so much and so quickly, boy, they're really behind the eight ball at times. Mm. Really behind the eight ball.
I want to get on to this mentoring thing. You mentioned you do some mentoring through Griffith Uni.
Mm.
What took you down that path?
Well, I don't know that it took me down a path. It was sort of a natural progression because I'd always mentored people. Mm. You know, every camera assistant that you've worked with, you're mentoring. Mm. And I've just been lucky enough to have mentored some good ones that have gone on, like John Stokes, Henry Pierce, Brad Shield. A lot of these guys have gone on to done great things. And I received a request from Griffith University, would I come and talk to the students?
Mm.
So I go and talk to the students, and then I get asked back again, and then someone says, look, could I ring you up and talk to you about stuff? And you say, yeah, sure. So that's where the mentoring role came from. Mm. And it's something I really enjoy. As long as the person who you're mentoring is prepared to understand that this is not going to be easy, and And if I want to succeed, I'm going to have to not only listen to what Ron's telling me, but take in a broad, encompassing arena of stuff that's going to lead me to the end result. Mm. You just can't rest on your laurels, not in this day and age with technology changing as quickly as it is. Mm. And so I do the same at Bond.
Right. Mm. Do you have a process in place for your mentoring at all?
Yeah, I tell stories.
You tell stories?
Yeah. That's all I do, Gary. What? I have nothing formal. I talk. I'm lucky I can talk, and I can tell students what they want to hear, how it's been done, how they should be doing it, how they should think about doing it.
Well, I think that's a great thing to do. It's interesting for staff, for the students, to hear stories of stuff that's actually happened. You know?
Yeah, and I'm not saying that's the be-all and end-all of it. I'm just saying, look, this is how I've done it.
Mm.
Now it's up to you to do it your way.
Mm.
And that's what I encourage, that they do it their own way. I do not enjoy talking to students who are just there to fill in time, and they stand out, you know, they're pretty obvious.
Mm.
I've found that the female students, in many ways, are more interested than the boys. They put more hours in. They're better at what they do. The boys see it as a rite of passage, whereas the girls are a little bit behind the eight ball, so they work harder. And we've had some wonderful women in our, I say girls, I mean women, in Queensland, Monica Maguire. I mean, my God. I mean, what a bloody talent that girl was. That's Andrew Wareham's wife.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, Jelly. She was my assistant for many years. Mm. A wonderful girl. And then there's many other women that have gone on in the Australian industry. They're just wonderful, talented people, but they all come with this badge of courage where they've had to work a little bit harder. And they've done it with a smile on their face. Mm. And they get the just reward for their hard work.
How important is that smile on the face thing in this game, do you reckon?
Oh, I think it's very important. Mm. I think you've got to... I mean, and I never... I used to be able to do it well. Now I don't, because I'm getting old and grumpy. But that turn in the other cheek, you know, it's a hard thing to do, to admit that, well, maybe this is a better idea than what I've got going here. Maybe we should listen to it. And, you know, the one person who was always good at that, and we were talking about before, was bloody Greville Patterson. And he had a unique way of dealing with it, the way he would deal with you. And that was always to say, in that little voice of his, that, what if, you know. So we had the T-shirts printed, what if, for Greville. And he was the bane of our life. But in the end, if you listened, and he'd always say, you don't have to agree, you know, just listen. And I'm sure he put Noel Harris through hell at times.
I'm sure he did.
Because Noel, and I did a lot with Noel, and Noel was, I always found Noel to be a very interesting fellow to work with. And he was one of those guys who would work with you.
Mm.
He wouldn't work against you. He'd work with you. But he could at times just reinforce the fact that, well, no, that's not what I had in mind.
Mm.
And sometimes he would, you'd have a bit of trouble getting through to, well, maybe this is a bit better. It was the reverse of what Greville would do. But Noel was a fantastic, and you've probably found it, a terrific visualiser. I mean, he could visualise it in his mind long before you even said it, which is a very extraordinary ability. Whereas Greville... Well, Greville was just a wonderful communicator, and he knew people, what people were thinking. He knew the consumer's mind.
Mm. Yeah, I spent a bit of time with Greville the other day, and we recorded one of these with him, and I think that's one of his biggest, it's probably his biggest strength, is to actually really kind of get inside the consumer or get inside the product for a start, you know, and figure out, okay, how do I, you know, what's the heart and soul of this thing? You know, how do I communicate that?
And you're quite right.
Yeah.
You're quite right. I know he had... in recent times, we worked on some terrific campaigns, but he had a lot of... Because he was so extraordinarily brilliant, he had a lot of problems with people who didn't recognise that brilliance and wouldn't use it.
Mm.
They would come up with these inane fucking ideas, and I've been in meetings where I'd look at him and he would just... The head would drop, and you think, well, I'm not going to pass the ball to you, pal.
Yeah.
You know? And it would have hurt him. Yeah. It would hurt him because they didn't take the time to listen.
Mm.
What you had to do with Greville was listen to him.
Mm.
let him speak, take on board what he said, and then talk about it. And I found that of all the single-minded people in advertising, and he was very single-minded, he was the most open to another opinion. That's a bloody rare gift, Smithy, for someone to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And he had it. There were a few other blokes that had it too.
I mean, you've always been pretty open-minded and loud. Collaboration, you know, collaboration's a big word these days, you know.
I do enjoy collaborating.
Do you? Yeah.
As long as it's with the right person.
Yeah, sure.
And
people you respect.
Yeah, and that you respect each other. I think that's really important.
So, I think I asked you this before, but have you got any favourites that you've...
Commercials?
Yeah,
Mirage, I think.
Would
Mirage.
Yeah.
Toyota, the early Toyota stuff. Toyota, Australia, all that.
Oh, yeah.
Gravel. And I loved... there are so many. I loved all the early Coke stuff that I did in Sydney with Larry Larstead. I can't remember the campaigns, but they were very enjoyable. But I'll tell you what's interesting on those jobs. I couldn't do one day, and the campaign was called Coca-Cola Couples, and it involved, as the name implies, couples who were drinking Coke and they'd probably been to bed or, you know, young couples. You know, I did 2 days on it or 3 days because there were big shoots in those days. You know, you didn't faff around with a half-day shoot. If you needed 2 days, you did 2 days.
Yeah.
So this was 4 days, I think. Something today we're doing too. And I couldn't do one of the days. So they brought in Peter James, famous Aussie DP, Driving Miss Daisy, a lot of these great films. And Peter was renowned for his use of filters. And so I saw the stuff that he did, and I saw the stuff that I did, and I thought, Jesus, Johansson, you've got a lot to learn.
Oh, wow.
His work was just beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, God, it was beautiful. Because I didn't use a lot of filters. I just tended to shoot what I found and do my own way around it. Oh, God, it was a lesson for me. Just think about what you do a little bit more and push it to the next step. Because a lot of the work that I did, I could do... standing on my head. So when people like Greville came along, and Noel, Carl Spencer, I mean, Carl was another one of those guys that would just ask the question of you, you know, well, I know what you can do, but, you know, do you reckon you could do something else? You know, what else? You know, so you'd think, well, shit, yeah, I can. I can push. So you'd push yourself. Yeah. And something extraordinary would come out of that, you know.
Yeah.
What else did we do? Toyota and all that sort of stuff. Oh, and Defiance Flower. This was when Mojo was at its height.
I think I did something on Defiance with you, didn't I?
Yeah, I think you did.
Yeah.
And we did that thing that for the sledge. And I spoke briefly before about the sledge. You know, I loved working with the sledge.
Mm.
He was a bastard at times. He was a single-minded, arrogant son of a bitch. But Jesus, I loved him.
Yeah.
I really did, because he'd stand up for you. He believed in you. And... he'd go into bat for you.
Yeah.
But woe be tide if you didn't deliver the goods. You'd hear about it for the next month, you know. And we did that thing, that juice. And
that was beautiful.
Yeah, it was a lovely job.
Yeah.
But he never interfered and didn't let what he did get in the way of what the message was all about. I did a lot of good stuff, I believe, with... the Ball Partnership in Sydney. I know it's Sydney, but they had a fantastic creative director there called Tom Malt.
Right.
And the producer was Robin Willis. They were just nice people who let you and respected what you did, you know.
Mm.
But Brisbane was such a learning ground. Wonderful.
Is there one thing that you think you do particularly well or have done over the years?
Exteriors.
Exteriors.
Right. And people will say, well, shit, anyone can do exteriors, but they can't. It's harder to do exteriors than it is to do an interior.
What makes it hard?
Because you're dealing with the environment. You're dealing with what's out there. And the best at doing that is a man I mentioned before is, well, there's two of them, Russell Boyd and John Seal. And John Seal won an Oscar for The English Patient, which is exterior. And Russell Boyd, of course, bloody hell, where do you start with Russell? I mean, Picnic at Hanging Rock, Gallipoli, you know, these sorts of films. But yeah, I believe I was able to master exterior light.
Mm.
Yeah. And that came from doing those Mirage ads, you know, knowing where to put the light at that time of day
yeah.
to get the best out of what was or what, in particular, what wasn't there, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what I felt I was very good at.
That's cool, yeah. You say with your mentoring you tell stories. Is there something that you particularly try to pass on in any way? You know, is there some sort of...
Yeah, it's not brain surgery. We just tell stories through moving images.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't lose sight of that fact,
really. Do you think that storytelling thing is a bit of an eye-opener for some students when you say that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, because I get asked a lot of questions, and one of the questions I get asked is, how much do we get paid? You know, and I say, you get paid what you're worth.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's up for you to determine after you've had a few years' experience.
Yeah, it's probably...
What do you get paid? That's none of your fucking business.
Yeah, it's probably the wrong question to ask at this point in your career, too.
And a lot of them ask, and what time do we go home? And I say, well, you can go home right now because you obviously don't want to be here. I think if you're honest with them, they take a minute, but they soon understand that whatever you're saying for their own good because they're all good listeners. But as I say and I repeat, I think the girls tend to grasp it a little bit more than the guys do in some ways. Mm. That doesn't mean they're going to be cinematographers or directors. Directors probably, but not a lot were going to be cinematographers. Some will.
That's an interesting thing to say. Why do you think they may not go on to be cinematographers?
Well, we've experienced...
But we'll direct.
Well, we're experiencing that now in our cinematographer society, where they'll join as students,
yeah.
but they won't go on and become full members, which means they're a working cinematographer. They'll tend to go off at that stage into other areas.
Right.
They'll write, direct, edit. And we don't know what the real reason is. My theory is that sometimes it gets a bit hard for them physically. There are some that will howl me down if they hear that, you know. But I think that happens. Certainly not creatively.
Mm.
Creatively, they're well and truly above on par. Yeah, well above. But and they go on and do other things. They have children. They get married. They have other careers. And they decide, no, that industry's not for me. We'll go somewhere else. But there are the ones that go on. This young director who's just done this film called The Last Impresario, Otto, Gracie Otto. Man, there's a talent, you know. There's a talent. But it's in her blood, you know. She's an Otto. Yeah. It's in her blood.
Okay, so you're still shooting? You're still doing stuff
now?
Yeah. What's some recent stuff that you've done? Anything of note, or are you just...
I don't do anything of note anymore. Although, no, I'm lying to you. I worked through Black Lab... with Karen Haywood, who you know very well.
The lovely Miss Karen.
The lovely Karen, who has been with me, and I'll say with me still, I don't know, 25 years or something?
Right.
Since she left you.
Yeah.
And she's an outstanding girl.
Yeah.
And she's still always be a girl to me. She's just a terrific girl. And we still work together. I did a job, nice job before Christmas, but it wasn't with Black Lab, I did it with Steve Cooper for Dreamworld. Which was a new Indigenous experience, which we did a multi-screen presentation, which was a lot of Indigenous dance and green screen, and it's now playing at Dreamworld. It looks fantastic. It was really nice to do something of that size again, you know.
Yeah.
There was a good money involved, so you could spend the money properly, you know. Commercials, I've just done some for John Anderson with Black Lab for Queensland Country Health Fund with another wonderful young woman, the Australian netball captain, Laura Geitz. And that was good. It's always fun working with Johnny Anderson. I enjoy it. We have our moments, but it's quite a delightful experience.
It sounds like you've got a pretty good work-life balance these days. You've got a nice environment here. You're doing some mentoring, you're doing some lecturing and teaching and that sort of stuff, and still shooting and still enjoying that. So
yeah, I do enjoy shooting, Gary. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I don't think it's something that ever leaves you.
Yeah.
Once a cinematographer, I think you're always a cinematographer, and you'll go on and do other things. But I do love it.
Yeah.
I love it. I don't necessarily enjoy all of the things that I've experienced, but that's what makes up the whole industry, so you do it. I've made some wonderful friends, I can tell you that.
That's cool.
Wonderful friends.
Yeah.
Lifetime friends.
Yeah. Well, Ronnie, I'm going to wrap it up at that.
Very good. That's a wrap. We'll check the gate. We don't check the gate anymore. There is no gate.
No gate now.
No, there's no gate.
But thanks for talking to me.
Pleasure,
Gary. And Joe, you're a legend.
I'll get out. Thank you very much, pal. Good on you.
This has been a BADC podcast celebrating 40 years. Spoken and authorised, P. Davies, somewhere in Brisbane.